Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you again with the opportunity that I'm very much looking forward to, which is to discuss a paper from our latest installment of the State of the Science series that began many years ago now. I'm not exactly sure in which order you'll listen to them, but this is the second of the two papers that I'll record a podcast on that was stimulated in part by the 30-year anniversary of the Edinburgh Declaration, which was a worldwide effort to put forward recommendations for how to modernize and improve the quality of medical education that was being conducted. This was in large part a chance to offer some retrospective on where we've come across those 30 years and where we might still have to lead with respect to the 12 recommendations that were put forward. The sixth recommendation in that document says, complement instruction about the management of patients with increased emphasis on promotion of health and prevention of disease. To take on the challenge of writing about where we've come in that regard, I was thrilled that Richard Hayes was willing to participate, and he has published a paper titled Including Health Promotion and Illness Prevention in Medical Education, a Progress Report. And by way of introduction, I should mention that Richard is affiliated both with the University of Tasmania Rural Clinical School in Hobart, Tasmania, and James Cook University Division of Tropical Health and Medicine, which is up in Queensland. And more to the point, at the moment, I understand, Richard, that you are traveling around the countryside trying to help out in a variety of rural and remote locations. So I'm impressed by how well the technology was able to find you out in the outback, quite literally, I guess.
Yes, well, sometimes things work well. Look, thank you very much for asking me to speak about this. It's a topic that I've been rather close to for much of my academic life. So I look forward to trying to explain a little more of the background, you know, why I approached it in a particular way and where I got the information from.
Yeah, well, knowing that you had considerable influence in this domain and have had a long-term interest yourself, I, as I said, was very happy that you were willing to take on this challenge. I think I'll start the conversation actually by asking you, given that it's quite a broad charge to put to someone to write on how we've progressed in terms of building in health promotion and illness prevention to our medical education processes, do you mind, first of all, sharing with our listeners some background as to how you chose to take on that challenge?
Yeah, sure. 1988 doesn't feel like that long ago. At the time, I was in the midst of my PhD, which was around measuring performance in general practice primary care medicine in Northern Australia. And that was a tremendous intellectual journey. But there was some early literature at the time, which I think shaped the Edinburgh Declaration, which was saying that really we had to look beyond episodic care to improve the healthcare of our target populations, of our communities. And I managed to build this into some of the work I was doing for my PhD. And I was struck by some interesting thinking at the time, which said, well, there is this exceptional potential. And they were the words used. When you have a few minutes of time of somebody who consults you professionally to try to do something that might help them become more healthy by becoming better educated about their problem, more able to contribute to joint care decisions. And it was a way of thinking that at the time was new to me. When I think about it, it shouldn't have been new to me, but I think in medicine we often think very much about solving the problems we are presented with today rather than trying to be more proactive about helping people and communities take greater control. So I found this to be a very interesting discussion. I built it into my PhD. I must say I didn't find very much evidence of uptake, but my PhD was around introducing the concept of how one might measure performance, and the primary focus was self-awareness and self-evaluation. And I found that there were many useful discussions with the postgraduate trainees in specialty general practice training about thinking about approaching patient care a little differently. Personally, I've continued to practice primary care medicine throughout, and I think I've always had that interest personally in looking beyond the obvious of a presenting complaint. And words like continuing comprehensive care come to mind, which cover a lot more than just this topic, but trying to get out of episodic care mode and to work with people to be more empowered and communities. It was very interesting when you asked me to look at this 30 years on, and of course what I did, being an academic, is I thought, well, I'm going to go out there and find the evidence for how this has changed. And it was quite intriguing to me that there was very little out there. There was still a lot of principal, conceptual papers about how important this was. But I found it very difficult to find any real evidence that this concept had been picked up as a routine part of medical practice outside of some academic primary care medicine papers. That was the field I was in, but clearly that was the field that had been most effective.
Mm-hmm.
And then next to that, there was quite a lot of controversy in public health circles about whether or not this was a role for doctors, or was this really a role for health system and other players. And there were fascinating discussions around, if you want to change behaviour, you know, high impact television commercials or whatever are the most effective, and what an individual health practitioner might do in his or her few minutes of allocated time is probably not very effective. Now, there was no clear outcome of that, but I found myself reading some very interesting articles that were still very political, still very much at the conceptual stage, and I found not a lot of evidence that the concept of formally teaching health promotion and illness prevention had been picked up, adopted, and shown to work in undergraduate or postgraduate medical education. There was almost nothing mentioned outside of public health and primary care medicine.
And you've just hit on two things that make me particularly intrigued by both the topic and the effort you made to track how we've progressed in this regard. You know, while 1988 doesn't seem that long ago, it was a bit surprising to me, living in this current time, that so recently we had to deal with that controversy. It's almost become self-evident to me, and the conversations that I hear going around, that health promotion and illness prevention should be an important part of care. Do you mind elaborating a little bit both on the controversy, but also do you think the evidence is lacking because people just haven't been studying it systematically, or do you think we really are still in a state where there might be some hand-waving around the issue, but it hasn't become a central part of our actual formal educational activities?
Yeah, look, there's a number of fascinating questions in there, Kevin. So I think the first thing to say is, one thing I discovered is that there is a need to agree on terminology here. And some of the emails I've had about the paper since it was published reflect this. People have said to me, why are you talking about health promotion and illness prevention in the same sentence? They're two completely different things. And, you know, recommendation six tends to bundle these things together, mm-hmm. and it's actually a huge topic. Then the next thing is, well, who plays a role in what? So if we look at health promotion, this is where there is the greatest controversy, and people are saying that, well, you know, an individual health professional can't really do health promotion. And this is where the influence of legislation, mass media campaigns, and social media campaigns have shown to be very effective. And certain countries have moved against smoking, and Australia is a very good example of that. Australia has had a rapidly declining rate of smoking. Very few young people start smoking. It's down to under 20% of the population smoke tobacco. And there's packaging laws and bans on advertising at major events. And it could be argued, I think probably quite rightly, that has that happened because people like me have said to children at consultations, you really shouldn't smoke? Or is it because the big end of town corporations have been legislated out of marketing to children? So that's one area where I think that the public health politics lobbying group can probably rightly say, well, that's actually our business, it's not yours, as much as we would like you to think it's a good thing. The next area, illness prevention or disease prevention, this becomes fraught because, again, there's a definitional thing. So I think every health professional would accept that once somebody has a disease process, that to modify risk factors is extremely sensible. So this is where if you've already got chronic obstructive lung disease, you've really got to stop smoking. And I think that that's pretty much embraced, and many people would see, well, that's actually part of managing the condition. It's not necessarily disease prevention. There is this classification of primary, secondary, tertiary. And I think that the medical profession has continued to do secondary and tertiary preventive medicine probably quite well. That has improved dramatically, for argument's sake. I don't think I'm that old, but I often remember as a student sitting in a respiratory medicine clinic where the respiratory physician was smoking between patients. Now, that would be absolutely impossible to imagine now, but back then it happened, and I think there was not such a broad acceptance that smoking had to be stopped, that it was seen very much as a personal choice and you give advice and it's up to the patient to decide. But when you come to primary illness prevention, that is, by definition, you are trying to prevent bad things happening. Again, this is where it's controversial around, do individual health practitioners have a role in this, or is this a community-wide, again, political lobbying kind of approach? And most of the public health literature that I was able to identify in the last 30 years about this is focusing on those two areas, health promotion and what I would call primary illness prevention or disease prevention. And for them, it's a system-wide, multi-level, multimodal, often very political, high-level set of strategies. Whereas I came into this thinking that, well, maybe it's a conversation that individual health professionals can have with their patients, because there is evidence that patients will listen to a respected source like that if it's connected to their health. And I refer to some of that evidence there, but that's fairly old evidence rather than very recent evidence. So that was the evidence around when I was beginning in this. And as I said before, I had a lot of trouble finding much evidence that things had improved. And the evidence that was there was saying, well, if you want to get medical graduates to role model, promote health and illness prevention, and to become evangelists for it, you've got to construct their learning programs such that they, as individuals and as a cohort, are very engaged with health promotion and illness prevention activities. And there are some very interesting models there about medical schools adopting certain community programs, and students almost in parallel and in addition to their medical programs are out there as activists working with communities and groups of individuals. But this is a minority. Not many schools seem to do this well enough, and then they don't seem to document it or document an evaluation of it. But there is some literature there about those strategies.
Well, it does seem like you were able to identify some indication that the programs that claim social accountability or those that are more subject to influential regulators might have been more likely to take up this cause. As you talk about whether or not schools are doing this better, you make me wonder whether the sort of lack of progress might relate to what you note is the discussion actually changing, and maybe the rhetoric has become better given the issues that you just highlighted, and you note how the discussion has moved on to things like patient safety and the health of doctors and planetary health. Do you think that's a transition that's more effectively positions the discussion, or do you think we've lost something in the translation?
That's a very difficult question to answer from the perspective of the literature. So what I can say is that having looked at the standards of many of the leading nations with respect to regulation of medical education, illness prevention health promotion appears. It figures quite prominently, or at least mentioned, in most of the major jurisdictions around the world. So it is possible that this is just done, ticked off. Everybody graduates with awareness of these concepts and the strategies, and yes, time to move on to other things. It's also possible, and it's very difficult to know about this because there is such diversity in medical education, even with nations, but certainly across the world, that there's a flavour of the month or a flavour of the year or a flavour of the decade or some other thing comes in. So I guess I've spent a lot of time in program design and evaluation of medical education programs, and I would suggest that probably 80 to 90% of a medical curriculum in most places of the world almost writes itself from a whole bunch of norms, professional and academic, and it's heavily biased towards bioscience because that is very important. That's how we work out what's going wrong with people, that's how we work out diagnostic tests, and that's how we work out treatments, and particularly drug and these more modern genetic treatments. So there is this strong imperative to fit more and more of this stuff in the curriculum, and there's been tremendous growth in immunology and genetics development in the last 10 or 20 years. And therefore the question is, what do you leave out? Or what is the room for this additional stuff that's nice to have but maybe not essential in some people's eyes? So, as I say in the paper, the more socially accountable schools tend to take a very different approach to medical education from the ground up. They are much more consultative of their communities in the way they set up and run and teach and assess. And they are far more likely to include, because of community engagement, the aspects of helping your community be healthier and more aware and more empowered in health. So there's that. But then you get things like patient safety. Now, this hasn't come from patients directly. This has come from regulators, I think, where there are some rather worrying statistics about iatrogenic disease and causes of mishap and death in hospitals, which are related to patient safety issues and the way we might, as professionals, perform our roles, either independently or, more importantly, as part of a big team. So the patient safety agenda is not really like illness prevention and health promotion, although you can kind of see a connection. But I think for a while there it became the flavour of this concept. And I think what I've tried to say in the paper is that there are these varying things that they're all related, and they become very popular, and people write opinion pieces and conceptual pieces about them. And there's a lot of discussion, and at medical education meetings, as you'd be aware, there's a lot of discussion about these things. But how well they're implemented, designed, evaluated in a more formal sense is another question. And planetary health is just one of the more recent manifestations of this. And planetary health is a lovely concept. We all want to live on a healthy planet. We know that this makes a difference to human health, as well as health of everything on the planet. But it's got such a broad agenda. It's around water quality, global warming, and rising sea levels, and the effect that will have on a lot of quite poor communities who can't afford it. And while these are fascinating and very important topics of discussion, is it the same as where we were 30 years ago? Because if we go to many parts of the world, there are still very high rates of smoking, very high rates of preventable disease, and quite shortened lifespan. So much of the progress has occurred in a relatively small part of the world, the more developed world, where there are legislative frameworks, there's regulation, and probably medical practitioners and other health professionals are behaving differently.
In those topics that you just raised and that progress you just described brings all the same challenges of the initial discussion, in that they each beg the question of how much of an influence can the individual physician have. So recognizing that we won't be able to get into all the details of the paper, it seems like a natural place to end to ask you to reflect a little bit on where we're going over the next 30 years, given that you've made such an effort and offered such insight as to where we've come from. I don't want to ask you to become a futurist necessarily, but obviously you spent a lot of time on this, and I'm wondering where you think we're headed.
Yeah, I try not to be a futurist, because I think they're always wrong.
They are.
But I think we could be happy that in many parts of the world, no medical graduate will have not heard of these things. And that's probably progress, but it's a question of how much progress. I think we've got a lot of work to do around just what are the roles. And this is where we get into futurism, and it's very difficult to predict. There are now many, many, many more medical graduates per head of population. We're a sicker, older world in terms of the population demographic profile in many parts of the world. There are still battles to be won around the major diseases like cancer. We're all wanting to live longer. And I think we've got, certainly my generation appears to be very, very interested in how do I stay healthier for longer? So, you know, everybody's got a sick bit. Everybody does exercise. Perhaps everybody is a bit of an exaggeration, but I know where I'm going with this. But I think the population in certain parts of the world is now much more empowered and confident and willing to do this. And I think that's a good thing, and I think the conversation that began in terms of inclusion of this recommendation 6-30 years ago has been part of a very, very broad, multi-level set of strategies which have probably helped produce people who are much more aware, much more assertive, much more confident about influencing their own health. Now, whether or not individual health practitioners played much of a role in that is hard to tell, but I think there has been progress. And I've said that in the paper. I think there has been progress, but it's difficult to know how that progress occurred. In terms of the future and where to from now, I think we do have to probably try to unpack this very, very broad, complex message. Because I think that at the moment it's a confusing message, and I know that medical students are often very biomedically fascinated, and they want to see a link between this other stuff and their future practice. And I think it's not yet certain who's going to continue to do some of this stuff. In the developing world, there's no doubt that change is more likely to happen if you use far less expensive models than, you know, long-term trained health professionals out there to do it. And it's often around legislation and system change. But we are going to be faced with things like rising sea levels, flooding of communities. We're going to see much more urbanisation of communities around the world. And I think we maybe need to have an evolving understanding of what it is we have to do for people outside of finding cures for cancer and genetic manipulation and helping everybody live longer. Because I think we are going to see a whole bunch of pressures on health systems which are related simply to things like overcrowding. Does this mean that there'll be more infectious diseases? We certainly have had tremendous success around the world with vaccination programs in most countries. So I think this is going to continue to be an exciting, evolving place in medical education, where the concept of doing something outside of pure biomedicine will remain important, but it may look and feel a little different in different parts of the world. But so long as graduates into the profession knowing that there is more to being a doctor than understanding genetics and immunology and being able to do some procedures, I think that they'll be well placed to play roles in whatever community debates and legislative debates happen around some of those really big challenges to the health of humankind.
Yeah, well, and thank you for all your efforts and your successes at leading us in that direction and really helping to take a step towards unpacking that message as you described it. This is obviously something that's going to continue to challenge us over the next probably infinite number of years, as, at least as long as we don't get this planet too far away from ourselves. So for the time being, I'll just reference people back to your paper to get a bit more details that we couldn't cover in the short time we have together. You'll find it in the January 2018 issue of Medical Education. It's titled Including Health Promotion and Illness Prevention in Medical Education, a Progress Report. And the author who I've been speaking with is Richard Hayes from Tasmania and Queensland in Australia. Thanks again, Richard. I look forward to continuing to hear about the challenges you get in terms of how we need to unpack these further.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your interest, Kevin.